Psalm 16, verse 6 says, "The lines are fallen unto me in pleasant places, yea, I have a goodly heritage." And we'll go right back at the history of our country this morning, considering our heritage. The psalmist said, "Yea, I have a goodly heritage," and certainly we do. Brother Jackson, why don't you shut those doors for me? Thank you, sir. He's already ahead of me. We began considering the writing of our Constitution. We began looking at what the framers to the Constitution wrote. We brought up the fact that there was a lot of dissension among those that put the Constitution together, even to the fact that some of the great leaders of our nation at that time were not present when it was written. Jefferson, being probably the most renowned, who was not around when the Constitution was written, was in disagreement with a great deal of what was written there. And the reason for the dissent, we're going to go back and finish looking at the amendments in just a few moments, but the reason for a lot of the dissent was based on the philosophical viewpoint of a lot of the individuals that were alive in those days. Some people that had left England came to the United States, and they came to the United States basically not for the same reason that our forefathers came, which was to escape religious tyranny in England. But once the United States began to become productive, obviously a lot of people would transfer here in order to make a living, in order to secure some of the wonderful things that was true about this new country, and obviously an abundance of land and freedom and all those things. But there were people that came here to secure those things. They were not too opposed to the British way of life. They didn't object to the British system. And as a matter of fact, a lot of them appreciated having a king or a parliament over the top of them. Again, that's all the governmental system basically the world knew, other than just tyranny and dictatorship and that type of stuff. There hadn't really been a true exercise in democracy in the history of the world. And as they came, and it became more and more evident that the United States at a point in time was going to sever its relationships with England, different allegiances formed. And when we get to the war, we've got those that actually supported the government of Britain, supported the British Army during the Revolutionary War, who lived right here in this country. They're called Tories. And they supported the British. They were in favor of the British winning the war. This was not everybody in America against everybody in Great Britain. It was some of the people in America opposed to really some of the people in Great Britain. There were some members of Parliament that took the cause of the colonies, even prior to the Revolutionary War, and said, "Hey, they deserve their independence. We don't need to be dragging this burden around." So there was dissension on both sides there. Now, I said that to say this. Once America had separated itself from England, those who were what we call moderates, and I use that term because we hear it in this day and time, a moderate is kind of a middle-of-the-road kind of guy, and those who were moderates in that system, after America had separated from English rule, of course, were those that really, now that America was free, great and wonderful, but they hadn't really seen anything wrong with the British system at all. And so as America began to frame its own system of government, those moderates play a key role, as well as what we would call maybe conservatives today, although Jefferson really considered himself a liberal. So, you know, things change, folks. I guess they do. In the days of Jefferson and Washington, the conservatives were the people that sought to establish something that was much along the lines of what England had. In other words, conservative is opposed to great change. And they liked keeping the system they had in England. So they were the conservatives. The liberals of the day were Jefferson and some of the other guys that said, "Hey, we don't want what England's got. We don't want anything that's even close to what England's got." You see what a great departure that was from the norm. So they were considered liberals. And again, realize things changed. Jefferson certainly would not fit in the camp of the liberals today. As a matter of fact, most of the Republicans, it's amazing if you follow history, Republicans back during the Civil War were the liberals. That's what we call liberals. The Republicans were the Abraham Lincolns and the fellows that were fighting to preserve the unions. The people that were pro-states' rights in the days of Lincoln were the Democrats. And now it's just the opposite. Today, the Democrats are pro-big government, pro-obtrusive government, and the Republicans are pro-states' rights. And so be careful as you study history. You can't come up with a term that will apply to everybody at every stage of development of this country. we were at a meeting, I guess this was back before the election. Yeah, it was. We went to see President Bush downtown, and we were standing there in a long line and waiting to get into where President Bush was going to speak. And there were some men in front of us who were black, and there were some other men driving around the block, you know, ridiculing people standing in line, and they also were black. So I don't want you to think there's anything racial involved here. They both were black. But as they came around again, one fellow standing there was an elderly gentleman, black fellow, and he looked across the street there, and this fellow said something, you know, derogatory about the Republicans or whatever, and this old black man, white hair, lifted up his hand. He said, "Son, you better remember who set you free." It was the Republicans that set the blacks free. And you know, the things change, the names that we can apply change, and sometimes to call somebody a liberal in the days of Jefferson, we'd have been on the sides of the liberals. We'd have been liberal, meaning we wanted to change as far as we could from what England had. In this day and time, what a dreaded thing to be known as a liberal. And a liberal is one who wants to change as much as they can from what America was based and founded on now. So the names change. Jefferson and some of the others, we talked about Patrick Henry and several other patriots whose names have come down to us throughout history as great heroes, they were the dissenters, and they were the liberals. They were the ones that were not for maintaining what England had given us here in the colonies, but changing and coming up with a system that would work. But their ideas and viewpoints were influenced by a man by the name of John Locke, L-O-C-K-E. And I don't know if anybody will ever pursue this any further, ever want to read any deeper about the foundations of their country. But if you ever wanted to study American history before America was America, if you ever wanted to study the roots of our system of government, you'd have to read the writings of basically three individuals. And two of them took their cue from the first one, who was John Locke. And John Locke wrote a treatise, several treatises, about man and man's rights and government's involvement in man's rights and religion's involvement in man's rights, and basically spelled out 90% of what your American government resembles right now. Under him came a man by the name of Montesquieu. And Montesquieu, of course, obviously with a name like that, was a Frenchman. And he took his cue from John Locke and incorporated the ideas of John Locke and came up with his own philosophy again, but also resembling very strongly what we have here in this country. The French were watching America and its development. Of course, the French Revolution occurred not very long after our own revolution. And there were those in France who knew the time would come when France would have to change its method of government. They were watching America. Of course, one of the most famous books written is Democracy in America, written by who? What an intelligent bunch of people I have this morning. Alexis de Tocqueville. And de Tocqueville came to America, right, you'd remember that name, right? Alexis de Tocqueville came to America right after we had established our system of government to see what it was that made America great. And when he returned, one of the things that he said was, I could not discover the conditions or the reasons for America's greatness till I went into America's churches. When I went into America's churches, I saw the pulpits of fire with fervor and zeal, and the preachers preaching righteousness and goodness, and I discovered there the cause for America's greatness. He said, America is great because America is good. And if America ceases to be good, America will cease to be great. That's de Tocqueville. And the French were watching. Montesquieu had laid out a foundation that de Tocqueville and others were considering and looking at, but he had been influenced by John Locke. Also was Blackstone. Blackstone, an Englishman, who took what John Locke and Montesquieu had established and basically rewrote the system of jurisprudence, or the system of law, and how law applied to man, and how law was to function in the realm of a free society. And what's interesting is Blackstone was used as a basic law textbook in law schools in America right up till about the 50s. When some real drastic changes took place. But Blackstone's law was the law book up until about 1950. And you learned law, you learned it from Blackstone. So those individuals influenced Jefferson and these others that had come. Of course, Patrick Henry was a lawyer, and I'm sure as a lawyer, his influence by Blackstone could be seen in the viewpoints that he had. But let me read you a little bit of a introduction to some of John Locke's writings that was preserved. It said, Jefferson and Paine, neither of whom was a member of the Constitutional Convention, were among the very few early American thinkers prepared to accept Locke's idea in full. And his idea was that the people have the right to decide, exclusively and totally. The more conservative members of the Constitutional Convention, who frequently identified democracy with anarchy and mob rule, you had men in the Constitutional Convention that thought democracy was the same as anarchy and mob rule. Well, how would they get that kind of an opinion? The opinion came because they were very much monarchical in their ideologies. In other words, we have a monarch here to make sure that everything's run right. If you let people make their own decisions, you're going to have a mess. You're going to end up where anarchy, no government at all. How can everybody have their viewpoint expressed? How can everybody have their own rights? It won't work. So your conservative members, and again, you're talking Madison and Monroe and some of these other, Franklin, some of these other fellows that arrived at that convention, they would be considered conservatives because they couldn't see the people governing themselves. Let me go ahead and read that again. Who frequently identified democracy with anarchy and mob rule, contended that popular control meant to end all personal and property rights, and insisted that transient majorities would act too often in hasty and ill-considered fashion. So you had men in the Constitutional Convention that didn't believe you had a right to private property. You had men in that convention that didn't believe you had a right to vote. This is a side of American history you need to realize. Sometimes we get the impression that, boy, when they went into that room, everybody was in agreement. Boy, they just put it on the table and everybody wrote it out, and that's what we've got. And what we've got in Washington is a result of what these men wanted. No, what we have, what we had, was a compromise from these individuals. And one side didn't gain height or altitude above the other with its viewpoints, and what you're beginning to see in America now is a turn back to what was then considered conservatism, but now it's classified as liberalism. And the thought process is that the majority cannot be trusted, the majority is ignorant, the majority should not be given a right to private property. You're seeing all of those things turn back. You say, well, those people are un-American. No, they're really not. Those people are as much American as you and I are, but their efforts were stymied in the Constitutional Convention of 1787. But now their efforts have seemingly come to the surface, and they're trying again to undo what was done to them back in the 1700s. In answer to these same objections 100 years before, Locke had argued that, on the contrary, quote, the people are not so easily got out of their old forms as some are apt to suggest. They are hardly to be prevailed with to amend the acknowledged faults in the frame they have been accustomed to, and if there be any original defects or adventurous ones induced by time and corruption, it is not an easy thing to get them changed, even when all the world sees there is an opportunity for it. These conservatives were afraid that every couple of years the majority would want to change its form of government. Locke's position years before is when the majority is concerned, it's not easy to get the majority to change. Even when there are faults in the system, the majority is more apt to remain with a system that has faults than to change to something that's untried and proven. That was Locke's contention. That's what Jefferson believed. That's what Patrick Henry believed. And that's what framed the ideology that these men had. Locke recognized, as few conservatives and radicals have done, that most people are not anxious to form major changes in policy or institutions unless driven to them by a prior condition of chaos. Locke said people are not going to change unless chaos comes out of what they've got. And that's basically what you've ended up, you know, where you're headed right now, is back to chaos. Popular inertia and skepticism of all new institutions act as brakes on the most demands for revolutionary reforms. And again, all he's saying there is you don't have to worry about the majority changing its form of government every year or every 2 years or every 4 years. It just look at this last upheaval in Congress where the Republicans moved in mass. That's the first time in 50 years you've had a change like that. Let me ask you a question. How long have people been complaining about the government the way it works? You see, the majority of people have believed this government was not running right for probably longer than 25 years. But the majority is not quick to change until it has extended every avenue of attempt to correct what's wrong. And that Locke was proven right again. It's amazing how intelligent some of these people were who wrote years ago. Now, I just read that to you. Locke's got some good writings, and Locke was a saved man. You read his writings, he talked about the Lord Jesus Christ. Locke was a good man and laid out basically the foundations of what you have. I also wanted to give you this. Now, first of all, I read this to you to give you an idea of why these amendments were so important to some people in our government. These people were not sitting back just looking at war heroes. These people were sitting back looking at people that were really pro-English, pro-monarchical system, pro-parliamentary rule, and they didn't trust them. And because they didn't trust them, when the Constitution was handed out to the states, we talked about it before, a number of the states wouldn't ratify it. And the two largest states, being New York and Virginia, didn't have anything to do with it. And you think, why? Were they opposed to America? No, they weren't opposed to America. They were opposed to giving the Madisons and the Monroes too much power for fear that they might sweep us back into a system much like the one we had just come out of. Because of that, the arguments were made in both New York and in Virginia, as well as several other states, that if this were to be a valid document for all of the American people, there must first be a spelling out of the rights that government cannot infringe upon. And that's why you have your Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights was incorporated within just a couple of years after the acceptance of the Constitution of America. It's considered in most every phase as a part of the Constitution, even though it was added on later. Because of the fact the Constitution wouldn't have been ratified had it not been for these, or this spelling out of the rights of the citizens of America. But now to give you another ideology, when it comes down to religion, John Locke wrote a treatise called A Letter Concerning Toleration. And I want to read to you what religious toleration, you know, I heard somebody say the other day when our constitutional framers placed the Constitution, they wanted to make sure that there was religious toleration. That's true. But listen, if the term liberal has changed, and Republicans now believe what Democrats believed 150 years ago, what makes you think the term religious toleration might not have changed as well? You see, we live in a society where a media uses phrases either to, well, always to its own advantage. And if it means they have to dig back here and find a phrase to confuse you or to coin a new phrase, they'll do that, no matter what. But here, John Locke, again, was the main individual who influenced, as a matter of fact, I think we saw the video that of all the quotes made by our forefathers in all of their writings, somebody took all the writings of our forefathers and analyzed who they quoted Montesquieu more than anybody else. Okay, Montesquieu was a student of John Locke. They quoted Blackstone and John Locke, second most frequently, but more than any of those, they quoted the Bible. So if you want to know who influenced the framers of our Constitution, these are the people you have to read. Here's what John Locke had to say about religion, all right? Too often when the church and state are tied closely together, the state decides upon the teachings of the church instead of the church guiding the state along a moral path. What's John Locke talking about? Separation of church and state. Does that mean the church should not guide the state along a moral path? No. Locke said too often what happens is the state tells the church what to believe. It seemed to Locke more than a coincidence that the magistrate usually found that the church of which he was a member and which supported his program was good, while churches which opposed his government were subversive. Welcome to America. No man, Locke argues, can ever know all the truth about religion. We'll say amen to that. Well, none of us know all of it. The persecutor may be in error and the persecuted correct. Certainly no man has a right to force his religious views on another when those views cannot be proved by reason. That's what Locke believed. Zeal in forcing others is especially indefensible when the religion is based presumably upon love and charity for others. Hypocritical acceptance, not sincere belief, is secured at the point of a gun. So you can make people believe what you want them to believe. Now, Locke excluded two groups from his tolerance. Okay, John Locke believed in tolerating other people's religious views, with the exception of two groups. I give you about 15 seconds trying to figure out which two he believed did not have rights in his system. Atheists are not to be allowed civil rights because they have no moral basis for their judgments. John Locke said that. Catholics are to be excluded because of their allegiance to a foreign ruler. But John Locke said. John Locke influenced Jefferson. Jefferson said, he said, I believe there would never have been an infidel if it wasn't for a priest. Now, what are you saying? I'm just trying to get you to see that when our country was formed, everybody was saying, well, we believed in religious freedom for all. We did, but we didn't believe their ideologies had to be accepted on an equal basis with Christianity. That is not what we believed. We believed everybody had a right to worship any way they wanted to worship, but not that they should have a right to be accepted and incorporated into the system of our country. Our system was founded on a religious basis. Religion had its part, as we can see here in our amendments. These are biblically based. But the idea was not that the church and the state was to be so separated as that the church never had an influence on the state. But what they feared, along with Locke, was that, number one, the atheists, which would have been represented by the educational system of that day, that education might maintain or might begin to govern government and thereby exclude religion, or that Catholicism, which we've talked about in length before, which basically controlled all of Europe, that their fear was that Catholicism would be placed in a preeminent position in American life and thereby gain control of America as it had in Spain and France and Germany and Holland and everywhere else over there. And so they believe, hey, everybody has a right, but watch these groups right here. And let's put up a system so that those groups right there are not going to be allowed to take over our country. Now, I say that, and it was the Baptists that argued for separation of church and state. Why? Why would the Baptists say, hey, don't let religion get mixed up in the government? Why would the Baptist people do that? Because they feared that religion would destroy government? Is that what Baptists would believe? Do we teach that religion destroys government? What did the Baptists fear? Was not religious teaching in the government, but religious organizations that would gain control and bring about what they had brought about in Europe. The number one persecuted group in Europe by the Spanish Inquisition were the Baptists and the Anabaptists. Those people had come here, most of them had seen their families, friends, and everybody else around them executed just for being a Baptist. And they said, we don't want that here, so let's put something in here that demands that these people are not allowed to gain control of our government. Now then, you say, why'd you go through all that? Because our First Amendment guarantees you the right to freedom of religion. You want to see what a contrast that is? In Europe, where a church was in control of the government, if you believed or practiced religion in a way contrary to that church's teachings, you were executed. But in America, where a church didn't have control of the government, you were free to worship and believe anything you wanted to believe. And that system of liberty could be protected as long as no religious organization was allowed to infiltrate the government structure itself. And so the framers of our Constitution said, hey, the number one amendment to this Constitution spells out that everybody, it's amazing that we've often been accused of being narrow-minded. We think we're right and everybody else is wrong. Have you ever heard that about the Baptists? You know, we're just so narrow-minded. These narrow-minded Baptists gave Catholics and Mohammedans and Jews and everybody else the right to worship any way they wanted to worship. You say, why? Because I'm going to tell you something right now. If what you believe is the Bible, you have nothing to fear religiously as far as philosophy or doctrine is concerned from anybody. I'm not afraid of a Catholic's doctrine. I'm not afraid of a Presbyterian's doctrine. I am not afraid of a Lutheran's doctrine. I'm not afraid of a Mohammedan's doctrine. Why? I know what I have right here. I can prove what I believe with the Word of God and logic. You see, the Baptists were never under a threat as to what they believed. What they were under a threat is the idea that Locke expressed where hypocritical belief can be secured at the point of a gun. The thing they feared was destruction at the hands of an army. And they had seen that throughout Europe under what was called the Counter-Reformation. They said, we don't want that here. There is no way that the framers of our Constitution believe that religious viewpoints or the teaching about Jesus Christ was dangerous to government. Nor do they believe that it was dangerous to other people's religious viewpoints. Now, I don't want to sound confusing to you, but that's the idea that's coming out of Washington today. Is our constitutional writers believe that if religion were allowed into government, then we would restrict people who didn't have the same viewpoints we had, you know? I mean, what about the Buddhists and the Mohammedans and all that group? Listen, the people that put our Constitution together didn't have that viewpoint. Their viewpoint was that Christianity, this was a Christian nation, and you can refer to their writings to find that out, that everybody had a right to worship the way they deemed necessary, but not to influence the government, but the government was not there to restrict religion from influencing the moral fiber of America. As can be seen in the laws that were implemented in this country. For instance, in the culture in India, where the Sikhs and basically those people are Buddhists and apparently all the terms they have there, the various religions, you want to see women mistreated, you take a look there. You want to see women, you talk about women not being liberated, go there today and take a look. But America had laws about what a man could not do to his wife. Even though she may not have had the liberties in 1776 she has today, she had rights guaranteed by a constitution put together by religious people. Now, what about the religious viewpoints of the Indians at that time? Are you telling me that the Americans believe that they couldn't impose their morality on their nation? What about those people that did not believe in back in some of those days, women were bought and sold just like slaves? Go back to the Roman system, pagan Rome. If you didn't like your wife, you had to pay somebody to execute her or bump her off, poison her, and then you went and married somebody else. And you couldn't even be tried for it. She was your possession. Now, why would this country impose laws that said, hey, you can't do that? Where'd they get those ideas from? They got them from this book. They got them from their religious morality, from their religious teaching, and they took their religious viewpoint and incorporated it into American law. What are you trying to say, preacher? I'm trying to say there are people that give you the impression that these people were so rigid they didn't want religion to have anything to do with their government because they wanted to protect the rights of all religions. No. They wanted to give all religions the right to worship, but not to protect their viewpoints. If their viewpoints were wrong, if their viewpoints were pagan, then we'll take the Word of God and disprove them and not allow them to be part of our society. But no group can gain control of our government. That's the idea. In other words, if you are Brother Feldman, this morning you're a Catholic, and over here, Brother Ray, you're a Methodist, and we just got Presbyterians and everybody here. What we've got is this in America. We know that all of us can't be right. But what we're going to do in America is what's never been done anywhere else in the world. We're going to guarantee that nobody gets an unfair advantage in deciding what's right and wrong. In other words, we're not going to give Brother Feldman an AK-47. Why? Because he could prove he was right real quick. Correct? Brother Howie even joined his church. So we're going to remove the AK-47 from everybody's hand. Why? Because we want everybody just to believe everybody's right? No. Because we want truth to be tried in the crucible of the Word of God and logic. You want to know who's right and wrong? Let's sit down at a table and let's argue about it. Let's push our viewpoints. Let's teach our viewpoints in our churches. Let's show our people what we believe. Nobody takes a gun. If somebody's won to your religious viewpoint or your religious viewpoint or my religious viewpoint, let it be because I have proved to them from the Scripture that I'm right, not because I've got a gun. Religion is all about. We've made freedom of religion freedom from religion in America. You may not see the danger of what's being espoused now, but let it be seen in the educational system. If our government means that religion has no right to infringe upon anything the government has ties to, you and I are in a lot of trouble. And you can prove that from looking at the school system. The government didn't run the school system. But when the government controlled or took control of the school system, all at once it had the right to push God and religion out of the school system. I'm going to tell you something else. The government controls your home. You say, I don't believe that. Wait 20 years. How many of you got a birth certificate for your children when they were born? File it with the Department of Commerce. You're controlled by the state. Well, therefore, well, I mean, hey, the state owns the roads out here, doesn't it? What if the state says, well, you know, if you're a Christian, we're not going to let you use the roads because we'd be promoting religion. You say, that's absurd. So was praying in school 50 years ago. And what you're seeing is exactly what Jefferson feared, was that the state would begin to dictate to religion what it had to believe and where it could go and what it could do. Taking us 200 years to get there, but as Pogo said, we have met the enemy and he is us. These rights were spelled out. We won't look at the first two. We've already looked at them and looked at them in detail. And I talked about the first one being the right to freedom of religion. There are several other aspects of that which are equally important to us. The right to assemble peaceably, the freedom of the press, the freedom of speech, all those incorporated in the First Amendment. Second Amendment is probably the next most important amendment there is in the Constitution. And that is the one by which we secure all of our rights. And that is the right to keep and bear arms. Okay? And it's an amazing thing. We talk about you know, the crime problem and all those things. Did you wonder where the Chechens and those people are getting all those guns from? Huh? You know what those Chechens have done? They're staving off the second most powerful military unit in the world. How are they doing it? They brought those tanks in there a week ago, and those Chechens sat down with anti-tank rockets and blew them apart. I mean, they just blew them apart. Well, aren't you glad they had the right to keep and bear arms? Or at least took that right upon themselves to keep and bear arms? Can you imagine, how many of you remember when the Russians went into, what was it, Czechoslovakia years ago with their tanks and just rolled right over the top? How many of you remember in Beijing several years ago where the tanks just rolled right over the people? They didn't do that in Chechnya, did they? You know why they didn't do it in Chechnya? Because a bunch of people had some guns. That's why. I have no idea. I guess nobody keeps records over there. I wonder if they were all yellow sheeted. You know, they all had permits to carry a rocket launcher. Now, you know, you've got civil disorder over there and chaos. And you say, well, you know, those people are going to die. That's one of your rights. You have a right to die for whatever you believe is right. And that's what's wonderful about it, is that if somebody comes and tries to enforce their viewpoint with a gun, you can take and withstand that viewpoint with your own gun. And the whole idea is of our country was not that force is the way to settle things. The whole idea was that if you're going to settle an issue, it needs to be settled on logic and reason rather than the point of a gun. Rather than fear of torture and fear of death. That's what's been going on in Europe for 200 years. And so they said, hey, give everybody a gun and you don't have to worry about it. Nobody can make you believe or make you do what you don't want to do. You've got a gun, you shoot them. If you're going to be influenced, let it be influenced by the right, by reasoning, by logic, and then be influenced. And so we come to a place, you know, where crime is just rampant. And do you know, statistically, there are not as many people killed in America now as there were back in the 1700s. And we've got a great big population now. And a lot of the stuff about crime, I realize, is hype. But I'm going to tell you what, we don't have any crime problem in America that couldn't be solved with a handgun in every home. We really don't. Or a handgun fastened to your side when you went out in the street. And you say, well, you just go out and shoot people? No. I don't believe you have to shoot anybody. You don't have to shoot anybody. Before that little guy comes up and tries to take away your wallet, or tries to steal your car, or tries to rape your wife or daughter, he's going to look at that sidearm on your side, and he's going to contemplate now, do I want to impose force here, or should I use reason and logic? And when he realizes force doesn't work, and neither will reason or logic, he'll probably leave you alone. Right to keep and bear arms. Number three, concerns the quartering of soldiers in private homes. No soldier shall in time of peace shall be quartered in any house without consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. And again, the idea here is the government cannot make you take care of the army. Your home, you have a right to do in your home what you want to do in your home. And I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. I want to go way out of line here and seem stupid. But if we would teach people to live right and do right and be right, listen, I don't have to impose laws that are anti-homosexual. I really don't. I mean, if two queers want to get in their own home, they have a right, as far as I'm concerned, to do what they want to do. They do not have a right to come to school and teach my child. See? There's a difference there. You say, well, you're taking away their rights. No, go home, get in the closet, and do whatever. But don't come out here and hit me over the head with it. You see? When your perverted lifestyles get out into the public and begin to pervert the public, then you have infringed on the rights of everybody. And then there are restrictions. Those restrictions must be taken. Your home is your castle. You do what you want to there. I mean, if you want to burn it down, burn it down. I mean, get out in the road. If somebody makes you unhappy, you want to burn down the whole block, burn down the whole block. But don't expect the government to come in and rebuild it for you. If that's your way of, you know, of protesting, to burn down your own home, burn it to the ground. And then sit out there and freeze for a while. And then you probably appreciate the home you had. Number four. Amendment number four deals with search and seizures. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. You see the rights to personal property? We call that the invasion of privacy. Against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Now, this is one of the finest of our amendments. Great, great amendment. Thank God for it. The clause probable cause here has been greatly expanded in the last few years. And I'll be honest with you, sometimes there's a good reason for doing the wrong thing. And sometimes that good reason causes people to do the wrong thing. And it may not do any immediate damage, but it sets a precedent for something that could go wrong down in the future. And several years ago, the problem came up with our police officers being shot and killed in the streets by people that were carrying weapons. People knocking on the front door of home with a shotgun blast, killing two or three police officers, and going in to get evidence. And so what they did is they expanded the probable cause. Okay, notice there's no definition of what probable cause is. And so the definition of probable cause was expanded to give a police officer more rights in a situation. And I'm not in total agreement with them. I do tend to side with a police officer because they're the ones getting killed. It's easy for you and I to sit back and say, well, you know, it shouldn't be that way until you put on a gun and go knock on somebody's door. It gets a little different then. When you get out of a cruiser at 3 o'clock in the morning and there's six men in the car in front of you and you're by yourself, it's a little different then. Probable cause can be expanded basically to almost anything that causes a police officer to suspect you're doing something wrong, which makes the law very, very subjective. And the officer interprets the law for himself. I'll be honest with you, I think it's probably saved a whole lot of police officers' lives. I can remember two or three stops that we have made where the police officer said, "May I search your vehicle?" He doesn't say that to everybody. But he said, "May I search your vehicle?" And the answer was, I mean, there is no right answer. You know, when he says that, you're going to get your vehicle searched. But if you say yes, then he doesn't need probable cause. If you say no, then he has probable cause. See how it works? You say, "Well, that's a dirty, rotten shame." You'd be amazed what's been pulled out of vehicles. You'd be amazed what's pulled out of vehicles. And now I realize, I said, sometimes there's a good reason for doing the wrong thing. In the future, that's going to backfire. You give that ability to a bad cop, and there are some. And now you got problems. See? So our Constitution guaranteed us the right. Now, the way to protect that is the next section. Supported by oath or affirmation. Okay, I'm all for expanding a police officer's right to search an automobile. I believe before he does it, he should have a form in his automobile that he hands to the driver of that automobile, and then he signs himself stating his reason for probable cause. You say, why? Because then if he goes in and finds out he's wrong, he can be prosecuted for it. You see, when you give somebody a right without any responsibility, it gets dangerous. And if I was a police officer, I would be more than willing to write on there, "This man was elusive or evasive in his questioning. I tended to think that he might have a firearm hidden under the seat," and sign it. Okay, if I'm wrong, then take me to court. We'll settle it in court. But that keeps a bad cop from stopping, pulling over everybody and doing whatever he wants to do in their automobile. It has to be backed by an oath or an affirmation. I tell you, another place where it works is with the Children's Services. If you call and file a complaint against anybody, Children's Services will come keeping your name and your accusation anonymous and take the children out of that home. And you're not allowed to see what your accuser said or who your accuser was. As far as I'm concerned, that's a violation of the Constitution of the United States. You say, "Well, you know, sometimes though people..." Listen, if I'm guilty, come get my kids. But if you come get my kids and I'm not guilty, I'm coming after you. You say, "What'll that do?" That'll make you sure you, before you make an accusation, that you're making the right accusation. All right? That's an amendment. Doesn't work very well in this day and time, see? Our amendments are beginning to break down. Number 5, criminal proceedings. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless upon a presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia when actual service in time of war or public danger. What he's saying there, a capital crime is a crime that merits the death penalty. You want to see the hypocrisy of a society in which you live. I can't believe how gullible some of you are for CBS and NBC to make up your mind for you. You live in a society that is opposed to the death penalty. But in the last legislation called the Crime Bill of Washington, 53 new offenses were given death penalty sentences. Isn't it amazing to you that people that are opposed to the death penalty would put down 53 new offenses for which you could be executed? I thought they were opposed to the death penalty. Well, they're opposed to the death penalty around crimes that they themselves commit. That's the key. The law here states that you cannot be tried for a crime unless an indictment of a grand jury is considered the thing. In other words, nobody can just make an accusation on the street and take you into trial and have you hung before the sun goes down. The grand jury must sit and look at the evidence and then pass their verdict as to whether the evidence is enough to warrant a trial or not, and then the thing can come to a trial. Not only that, but the statement is made there that military people are under a different code of law, which is something we just screwed up here in the last few years. Even the people in 1776 realized if you're going to have a military operation, you had to have a military operation where the military governed themselves. And now we're trying to bring a military code of justice back under an American code of justice, and it doesn't work. You say, well, homosexuals have a right to be in the military. Not unless the military says so, and I don't care what the American Constitution says. The military has a right to set its own guidelines and its own rules. You say, well, that's not fair. That's what's wrong with America. It's eat up with this fairness idea. The danger in that is that we in America, we've never been in a wartime. You've got a bunch of people now deciding we want the military to fit these guidelines, and the people trying to fit the guidelines are people that have never been under fire in their life. They don't know what the heat of the battle is. They don't know what goes on. They have no concept whatsoever. Your first attempt at that came in back in 1968 or 1969 concerning My Lai, when Lieutenant William Calley was tried in a federal court for crimes committed against the People's Republic of South Vietnam. That's garbage. You say he was a murderer, then you let the military handle it. You let the military handle it. You say, well, he killed civilians. I just finished reading a book this week on it called A Wing and a Prayer. You know those bombers in World War II went over Bremen, went over Schweinfurt, went over Berlin, and dropped, I mean, you're talking 700 bombers. 700 bombers carrying 500-pound incendiary bombs and 3 1,000-ton high explosives. Each one. And begin to drop those bombs. They didn't give them an advance warning. They didn't say, here we come. They didn't say, get the kids out. They bombed. I have pictures of Cologne in France where there's one building left standing in a whole town. One building. Out of them. Can you imagine the city of Toledo being leveled and all left standing is this building? You say, what did those men do? They killed everything that moved. You say, well, that's terrible. That's what they thought. They didn't come back and say, goody, 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 we kill women and kids and babies. And they came back and wept and cried themselves to sleep and said, we wish the war was over and we could go home. We've got to end the war so we can go home. War's strange. You can't impose the same code on people in battle as you can on people that are just walking down the street out here. You take a soldier that wants to turn around and run, his turning around and running may affect 25 or 30 other soldiers in time of battle. One man fails to do his job, everybody in his company could be at risk. So what does that mean? That means the lieutenant or the captain has a perfect right to draw his service 45 and put a bullet right between that man's head for disobeying any order against him. That's what that means. We started to screw this up back in Nuremberg after the close of World War II. I am not in favor of Hitler. I am not pro-Nazi. I'm not sympathizing with Germany. But when we tried soldiers for doing what they were ordered to do in Germany, it was a travesty. How do you try a soldier for forcing people through a door into a crematorium knowing they were going to die? How do you try that soldier for crimes against humanity when you got bombers dropping bombs, killing people on the ground too? You know what there was in that airplane and on that ground was a soldier that he was sworn to an oath to do what he was told to do. Now, you want to try Hitler, you want to try Goering and Hess, you want to try the high command, fine. You try the people that gave the orders. You don't try the captain and the sergeant in the field that was obligated to carry out those orders or be shot. What choice did he have? You say, well, he enjoyed what he was doing. Maybe he enjoyed what he was doing because he knew he was carrying out his orders. I don't think he enjoyed it any more than the bombers that dropped the bombs or the soldiers that fired the artillery. I don't think you enjoy decimating villages and people. We break down the chain of command. This amendment goes on. Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense or to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb. That's called double jeopardy. You can't be tried twice for the same crime. Unless they try one on a federal level and one on a civil rights level. But I'll be honest with you folks, that's constitutional. They didn't do anything that wasn't constitutional then. And I'm sad it was done, but it was legal. nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And that's been changed a little bit. Nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. That's called eminent domain. If the state or the city wants to come in tomorrow and put in a road where you live, you lose. You lose. The state can take your home away from you tomorrow without saying so much as boo to you. And they can pay you what they think that the home is worth, what they think the home is worth. They set the price on it. And there's nothing you can do about it. But at least you have to be paid for it. They just can't come and take it. You say, well, what's the difference? Well, in Russia and in other countries, that's exactly what they do. They come and say, you've got to be off by sunset. Too bad you paid for this land. You just lose. All land belongs to the state. We've got a due process of law, and that is you're accused, you're tried, you're found guilty or innocent, and the law must obey what the findings of the jury are. And you have a right to trial by jury. Excuse me. In all criminal prosecution, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of the counsel for his defense. There are laws that are to be followed in trying a court case. You have rights. Now, let me spell this out to you so you understand it. If you don't go into court and demand these rights, they don't have to give them to you. I talked to a fellow the other day that went into a court, I believe it was in Michigan, and when he got there, he said, where's the jury? And they said, well, there's not going to be a jury in this case. He said, well, I have a right to a jury, trial by jury. They said, you didn't demand it back at the hearing, so it's not granted. You've got to demand your rights. You say, why? Government has always been antagonistic of your rights. Say, if you don't use your rights, you'll lose them. How could you lose your rights? Who would take them away from you? Government. And folks, you know, my fear is that you get the wrong idea. I'm not a revolutionary. I'm not advocating an overthrow. Nothing is further from my mind. I love my country. I love my government. What I'm trying to do is to preclude any naivety that you might have in thinking your government's on your side. No government is on your side. Government of necessity must be against its own people. You say, how can that be? They have to take your money to operate. They're immediately your enemy. And our Constitution puts limits on how much our government can do. And you better be aware of what they are so you can demand your government gives you the rights you're entitled to. Amendment number 7. In suits at common law, where the value of controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no facts tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. Once a jury finds you innocent, the state cannot take you back and find you guilty again, unless they try you in a different type of court. Amendment number 8, excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishment inflicted. And there's the argument now for the death penalty. Opposition to the death penalty is that the death penalty is cruel and unusual punishment. And yet cruel and unusual punishment is a generic or a general term that doesn't have any specifics to it. I believe intentionally. Because I believe the society of the day has the right to determine what is cruel and unusual. And I'm going to tell you something right now. Putting somebody in an electric chair and cooking them is not cruel nor unusual in this society. Amen. Listen, this society is violent and wicked by nature. You've got 5- and 8-year-old kids that can shove a 7-year-old boy out of a 3rd- or 4th-story window in Chicago to kill him. What do you think? An electric chair is cruel and unusual? You've got people who will stand in a circle around while a man beats his wife to death on a street corner in New York, and you think an electric chair is cruel and unusual? You've got a woman who can strap her 2 children in the seat of her car and drive the car off in the lake and stand there and watch her children drown, and you think an electric chair is cruel and unusual? Nothing unusual about that. What we're looking for is a penalty of death or a way to impose death without hurting the person. Who was it the other day? Somebody was talking to me about them having to change the needle. I guess that's Brother Gip. When they, you know, they give them a lethal injection, if they're going to give another one, they have to change the needle. Why? You know, well, we don't want the guy to get some virus. He's going to be dead in 15 seconds. What difference does it make? So you have the amendment number 8. Number 9, the enumeration of in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. In other words, the fact that the government has given certain rights does not mean that it automatically has the right to run over your rights. It goes back to our first right, the right to petition for redress of grievances. Just because the government says we have eminent domain here in America, you can still take that thing to trial. You can still force the government to prove its hand. And the government has been known to have to back down a couple times. I mean, you live in a country where your government is given specific rights, but even those rights do not supersede your rights, according to the Constitution. You can fight those rights. And that's what you're granted under the Constitution. The Tenth Amendment, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited to it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. And that's another one that's under fire here in recent days. And because of the last election in Washington, it looks like some of those powers may be coming back to the states. I say maybe because I'm not convinced anything's going to get done yet. I believe the states full well ought to have control of welfare. I believe the states ought to have control of education. I think the government has no business being involved in any of that. And I'm all for it. I advocate states' rights. I really do. And if Washington doesn't want to pick up its foot of the bill, you know, part of the bill, fine, okay. We'll just stop paying the federal and pay it to the state. I'd rather put my, I'll be honest with you, I don't trust Voinovich any more than I trust, well, I probably do trust him a little more than I trust Bill Clinton. But I don't trust him anymore than I trust Ross Dinkowski. But I'd rather put my money in Voinovich's pocket any day than I had Ross Dinkowski's because I keep an eye on it. Keep an eye on it. I can see what he's doing with it. And so rights not granted to the federal government are reserved to the states and then to the people. That's where the Brady Bill's run into a big problem here recently because the federal government says, well, you've got to have a background check in order to purchase a weapon. And people said, well, who's going to do the background check? They said, well, the federal or the state law officers. And the state said, wait just a minute. You can't tell us to take the people we're paying and do your job. That's a violation of the Constitution. And so that thing's wrapped up in court right now. And the Brady Bill may or may not end up becoming law. I don't know what will happen to it. So, but it's constitutional. Glad we got a Constitution that spells things out. The problem in America, to be honest with you, is the fact that, number one, American people became ignorant of what their rights were. Became ignorant of what, I think in a recent survey of high school students, about 35 to 40% of them did not know the difference between the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. You say, that's a third of the kids coming out of high school don't know the difference. And more than that, it's closer to 50 or 60% could not tell what 4 out of the 10 amendments of the Constitution were. Couldn't even have, they didn't have a clue. And some of you didn't either. Americans became ignorant of what their rights were. Government, as government always does in any society and in any place in the world, began to grow and expand and take away what people didn't know they were not supposed to take away. And before long, you end up where we are right now. And while our government is big and obtrusive and needs to be downsized, thank God, we still have control.